Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi from Brand Positive, a research, foresight, and strategy consultancy for corporates, agencies, and NGOs. I've spent 20 years working on catalytic projects around the world, and along the way have been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom are guests in this series, along with an array of other fascinating individuals. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, focused on innovation. My next book will focus on foresight. So, I hope you enjoy this podcast, which is brought to you in partnership with the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, a global leader in applying futures thinking to solve strategic challenges within organisations. But now, let me introduce today's guest. So today I'm really pleased to be talking with an incredibly interesting individual who I've known for a long time and who I've wanted to interview for possibly an even longer time. He is Jonas G. Mikkelsen, director at the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, where he oversees and is responsible for their publications, communications, initiatives and events, and their incredible alliances. So he will tell you all about that and more. But Jonas, hi, and how are you?
Hi, Sean. Thanks, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
So, Jonas, back in the day when you left uni, your first job was selling Harley Davidsons. So go on then, perhaps explain the very straight or windy road that led you from selling motorbikes to where you are now.
Yeah, very windy roads. So essentially, my background came out of marketing. And as a gearhead from when I was a small boy, that turned into a motorcycle expertise, and I started with Harley-Davidson first domestically here in Denmark and then later moved on to the United States and actually loved it very much, but I felt I had to do more studies. So the marketing experience I had from that industry actually turned into helping a lot of entrepreneurs around the world, especially around the university scene, and was in Cambridge for that. And then I went back into marketing, so to speak, where an old mentor of mine said, Jones, you always had so many crazy ideas working with marketing, but you were specifically focused on one brand. How would you like to advise different brands on it? And that was specifically marketing or advertising. So I got into an advertising agency, and that was TBWA, which is, of course, quite a significant player, as you know.
Sure.
And I moved up through the chains there. I worked for them in the Nordic region. I worked for them in Germany, spent some time in Japan, was in the States. Last stint was with their Shia Day office in LA. But I sort of transitioned in from going from the client side into asking way too many questions about why we did things a certain way and how we could utilize this creativity here for more than simply just branding or communication. Yeah. So I transitioned into more of a corporate innovation role, sort of an in-house Skunk Works guy, if you will. And that led to launching various experimental endeavors. But as it often goes, within that scene, I had a lot of frustration with that in any sort of, this is not pointing fingers at my old employer. I think it's just a common thing. There was this evident short-termism. Like when we looked at something, we looked 3 months ahead. It was this quarter-based thinking.
Yeah.
And there were so many opportunities that I saw, lost out on, and where you maybe a year or two later saw this brought in massive investments or really created something change-wise. And I got quite frustrated with a lot of the decisions that were made. So in the end, I needed to do something else, and I left advertising. Then I freelanced around the globe, essentially trying to do all kinds of weird experimental things. I had this new holistic approach to corporate innovation. But I was still looking for, okay, where can I go where there's not this short-termism? And I'd always been interested in how does an NGO actually work? And all of a sudden, the institute here, back home in Copenhagen, had to get a completely new executive management team. And they promoted two internally, and then they needed a third one, and they needed someone who could do something with their positioning and marketing, but also sort of give a new take, revitalize the organization. They sort of lost track of what they were here to do. And then I figured, okay, this is the opposite. This is long-termism that this institute is trying to promote. So maybe this is something for me. And there you go. Then we went from Harley-Davidson motorcycles into future studies.
Fantastic stuff. I mean, and on that, Matt, I know having spoken with you about this previously, that one of the, you know, one of the many things you're up to, which I find is so interesting, is looking into the sort of policy needs from the perspective of future generations that may have been actually entirely ignored in many cases until the very, very recent past. So go on then, Jonas. So perhaps starting somewhere, future generations. What's that all about? A, why should we care? And B, what is one doing about it?
Yeah, so...
how long have you got?
No, I think for why we should care, I think there's, of course, an element of posterity. Why are we here as humankind? I think that's a big answer I'm not able to give here. But I think there's something about continuity and keep existing. And if we want to do that, I think we inherently have to think long term, and I think that comes from a better place when we're trying to create representation for future generations, and also just to be specific, future generation, especially when we're talking about it in a United Nations context, is we're not talking about children and young people today. We're talking about those yet born, so the currently unborn at any given time. So I think a big issue we have globally, and this is also just in business or, you know, urban planning or whatever we do, actually, when we do some things long-term, we have a tendency to plan according to the present. And it's a major issue. I think I once mentioned that case for you where there was an urban city area of a big European capital that was going to be expanded significantly, and it was going to be done in 2070. And one of the things they were worried about was creating an infrastructure underground in terms of traffic and cars. And a lot of the engineering actually went into that drawing of even having the removal of, you know, fumes from the cars. So exhaust fumes, pollution, and especially also like diesel particles. And here's the issue. We're talking about 2070, there's not going to be diesel cars. I'm not here to predict the future, but I'm quite certain I can say that. So that is just a golden image of you're trying to build a future based on a present. And if you turn that around and you say, okay, future generations, what are the plausible futures, the scenario for potential futures that they're going to be living in? And how can we sort of see it from their perspective and looking back at what should we maybe have done or considered now in our time. Yeah. So that's essentially what that's all about.
Yeah, how interesting. And just to go through exactly what you're up to across the range of activities that you're responsible for at the Institute. So, be good to really unpack those and understand exactly where you're coming from. I know you're talking earlier on about, you know, strategic transformation, etc. So go on then. Yeah, perhaps just talk us through a few things that you are involved in at present for those that you're allowed to talk about.
That I'm allowed to talk about. That's another thing. Of course, break it down to something simple. I'm internally responsible for our strategic transformation, this whole repositioning of the Institute. It's been very much, how can we say, it's worked in the shadows for decades since 69, and now we want to step back into the spotlight. Externally, it means that I also oversee all of these, as you said, our publications, our alliance work. This comes in with the global movement Teach the Future. We share a so-called UNESCO chair together with Aarhus University within anticipatory leadership and futures capabilities. We also launch a lot of initiative, nonprofit initiatives ourselves to try to, essentially any initiative that we do, we might have a focus within a certain sector, say education or policy development within government. But it all comes down to essentially the core of two things. One is creating these or building these futures capabilities. And when people hear futures capabilities, what is that? Well, you've probably heard about strategic foresight or futures literacy, et cetera. It's essentially concrete tools, methods, and processes for how to explore the future, understand what it is you have explored, and then also act upon it. The second part is this whole representation thing. One thing for future generations, but generally also just the representation of the, how can we say, the neglected perspectives of the future in the present. So that's what we do there. Some of the specific stuff right now going on is, of course, that there's a lot going on within the United Nations, which is this year the General Assembly, and it's been announced for a very, very long time, is going to be called the Summit of the Future. There is currently something we've also contributed to at the Institute. There's currently a Pact for the Future in draft. The purpose of this pact is to essentially build upon the Sustainable Development Goals. As you know, they're running out here in 2030, and it might even, initially, there was even some talk about, is this pact actually going to replace the goals? Secondly, there's also going to be a declaration for future generations made, which we've also inputted on, and there's a lot going on that. We're looking forward to seeing the first draft here in early April. Of course, it is, as it is with bureaucracy and the United Nations, is that it's hard to get something in there, and they actually, there's, you know, concrete hardcore commitments, you know, actions. There's a lot of what and why, but not that much how. Like, how are we going to do these things? So those are headliners right now. There's a lot of networks coming together, civic society. There's UN's got this front against the private sector, which is called Global Compact. They're talking about how can companies and corporations, brands, step into this agenda? How can they take this upon themselves and actually do something from it? That's the big focus this year, the summit, and hopefully seeing something viable come out of it that we can use afterwards. And then I think it's more up to individual member states or NGOs or brands to actually go and say, well, this specific part is something we as an organization want to contribute to and that we can do.
How interesting. And so, Jonas, in terms of futures literacy and using strategic foresight properly, should we say, inverted commas, there are a lot of pretenders to the throne out there. So perhaps just talk about what sets the Institute apart from the rest.
Yeah, sure. No, absolutely. I mean, especially also with all the focus that the, as we were just talking about, the UN right now is saying, and it's becoming the new, I think foresight as a concept is becoming a new disruption, which we also all loved a couple of years ago. But I think one thing is our extensive experience. So the Institute is founded in 1969 by the OECD Secretary General. And I think the experience of contributing to the field for so long, we have a very specific way of working with foresight. It's something called the Copenhagen Method, which is actually currently, it's always an organic thing that is developing. And currently we're optimizing certain elements and they are backed by specific research. And I think that's the second thing where we as a think tank might differ, is that we come out of actually doing research, and then we have so many academic, I would almost call them suppliers, but they're collaborators and alliances, universities that go into the depth of this field, where we try to, how can you say, there's an academic sense of foresight where you go into the nitty gritty of the models and processes, and then what we specialize in taking that and making it into applied foresight. So I think from that end, we differ quite a lot with others who might have attended a course or anything. So I would say there's also a tendency in the market right now where more and more foresight practitioners are out there, and they can deliver to brands and organizations and whatnot. And we're actually seeing our position becoming more of a foresight supplier to the foresight practitioners, if you understand. Yeah. So essentially the agencies and these individuals and whatnot, they come to us to learn and then they offer it. Or we see more and more foresight people being employed in even senior positions within organizations as we move ahead. And we can also see that we sort of become their go-to in sense of not only their upskilling constantly, but also as mentors or anything. And then I think there's the futures literacy thing. So one thing is, of course, the concept of making society futures literate, but it is also important to understand that futures literacy is a specific concept by UNESCO. And it is maybe more so, at least for some, especially through, let's say, Teach the Future, it's addressed more against young people, maybe. But that's not necessarily the rule. It simply is because foresight as a discipline and also future studies actually came out of the 50s, the war years. So how can we, it was a military tool to sort of try to avoid these conflicts going forward. Then it became, so it was risk aversion, and then it also became a tool for organization, especially C-suites. They wanted like analysis or reports on future risks. So it became very much risk management. But all of this has sort of a negative narrative, right? It's you do it to protect yourself against the future. And that's, of course you can do that, but we're trying to change the narrative to a more positive approach. And that's essentially what futures literacy is trying to do, is also let it be driven by optimism, dreams and hopes, and then putting that into concrete models and processes of working and thinking these things. And the good thing is what we can see every time whether you learn the skill of foresight or whether you become quote unquote futures literate, is that we can see, we experience that people feel way more agency. They become more optimistic right now. There's so much futures pessimism, right? And there's so many things going bad. So everybody's having, especially young people, are having so much futures anxiety. But we can see that this is sort of giving them hope and direction and agency. And that, then again, that boosts their creativity, it boosts their innovation skills, and it boosts your mental health in the sense that when you have hope and optimism, that is inevitably healthy for you.
Yeah. Having said that, in terms of, go on, has to be asked, you mentioned obviously that there is at the same time a lot of unfortunate, should we say, sort of a realistic pessimism out there. So when one is talking to organizations, and it's again a sweeping statement, but you know, just for sake of this, so generally speaking, or should we say frequently speaking, when one is talking with organizations about what it is that they're worried about, perhaps from the sort of, you know, in terms of time horizons, short or medium or long-term futures, what are the sort of conversations that you're having there? What are people coming to you with in terms of their concerns?
I think a lot of it currently is this, and this is across whether it be in a corporation or a ministry or a civil society organization, there's this whole thing about trying to navigate increasing uncertainty. So one thing is that change is happening so rapidly that people are feeling the need to, I need some tools to address this or explore this, because right now it's all of it is just happening. I have this thing where sometimes when I talk to people about the future, it feels like I'm talking to them about a diagnosis, something that they're going to be, you know, trying to, we have to fight this, or something I have to fear or prepare for, instead of seeing it as an ever-changing destination. But that's really interesting to see what's over the hill. And I think you need the right tools and the right mindset for that. And then I think a lot of organizations are afraid of becoming redundant because they're seeing so much change now. If we're looking at just, you know, there's so much geopolitical stuff going around, there is so much technological development, just what, you know, just AI or quantum computing, what that is representing and the change it's making. We can see shifts in how people, let's say, recently we were talking about in a board meeting, which I can't, of course, refer to who it was, but we were talking a lot about that shareholders didn't only look at return on investment in terms of profit. They also wanted to see other things like impact or employee welfare. Like a lot of board members are now interested in like, how are your employees actually doing, which is a great, great thing. But that wasn't even on the table just 10 years back in most organizations properly. So I think there's a paradigm shift, and I think people are not quite sure what that's going to be. So uncertainty about the future is definitely what is motivating all organizations into getting onto this agenda.
Yeah. And in terms of those organizations, any ones that you think actually are dealing with the issue well? Do you look around you and think, you know what, now there's an example, let's say in a commercial context of a business that are actually taking the future or futures seriously and are preparing or whatever or planning accordingly? Any ones you point to as being, you know, best sort of practice?
Yeah, well, to be honest, I think we're currently experiencing a lot of positive tendencies from a lot of organizations. I think even if you're looking at many organizations are scaling up right now and they're restructuring around it. So one thing is some organizations are looking into how can we upskill our staff in general? You know, what positions, maybe even in communications, marketing, innovation, or whatever it might be, they're looking at how can we implement foresight and how will that benefit us? Will they also feel more agency, as we were just talking about, and then we have a strong staff? Other organizations are starting to look into planning further ahead. So they don't just want to plan maybe 2 or 3 years ahead. They now also want to look at what's our narrative on the long run. And I think you're seeing organizations like even McDonald's actually being quite far ahead on their internal foresight capabilities. So that's one that might surprise people. And of course, then also intergovernmental, I think currently not just the UN, who's launched this UN 2.0 plan, where foresight is one of the five pillars it's going to be built on. The European Union, I know, is trying to do the same. Who knows if we'll even see a European Commissioner for the future. So there's a lot on that. One thing I think is maybe missing everywhere is this whole, and it's really an interesting thing when you work across so many sectors, because I talk to academia, I talk to nonprofits, you know, the civic society organizations, and I talk to private sector, and I talk to government and intergovernment. And it's so weird that private sector, for an example, is very, very good at, you know, defining what they want to do and then plan it and execute it, straight to the how. The things they're always struggling with, it seems, is truly defining why are we doing this? What are we actually trying to achieve? You know, and sometimes it's just, well, staying in existence or continue to make a profit. And it's not really satisfactory, either to the people who are working with it or the organization as a whole. So I think they're missing out there. On the other hand, if you talk to an intergovernmental organization or those sorts, they're also quite good at saying what they want to do. And they're very good at defining why we do this and why it is important. But by God, they're not very good at getting to the how, like specifically how to implement these things and, you know, take concrete actions. And so I've always had this thing about we need to do more cross-sector collaboration, because I actually think that would be quite fruitful.
Very interesting. And on that point about the, talking about will there be a European Commissioner for the future? Remember, we were talking about this at a previous time, and you were reminding me about, that pivotal moment when, in terms of, you know, futures and foresight thinkers of the past, you know, H.G. Wells famously giving a talk at the BBC when he said that there, just as we have in a university context, endless history professors. We should also have professors of foresight.
Yes, it's very true.
Fantastic. And they've gone there just in terms of, so where do you get your information from then, Jonas? So, where do you get your inspiration from?
Well, I think the benefit of having a publications branch within the Institute is that they do a lot of, how can we say, almost, futures journalism. They go out and they're really in tune with what's happening everywhere. And I also think on the other side, we also have, some of our people who do substantial amounts of research on what's moving out there. And then the third leg is that we have these collaborations with academia and other labs and other think tanks such as ourselves. So there's a lot of information sharing. One thing I really loved about, one of the benefits of working within the civic sector is contrary to the private sector is that in private sector, you're trying to hide your secrets, right? You're trying to keep that competitive advantage. So you don't want to share too much knowledge with your competitors, or the industry at large. Whereas it's quite the opposite within the civic sector. We actually love sharing this stuff with one another. So you get a lot constantly, like every day I get briefings on things moving around. And then of course, I think anybody who works with this is naturally curious. So I also try to either go on and, listen to various podcasts or anything. I'm a big fan of the concept of serendipity in the sense that when something springs out of something you don't expect. So often I also use this when I worked with corporate innovation was trying to get someone's perspective, and this someone being an individual who did not work with what you do. So I love sitting down with one of my friends. He plays the bass in a band, and that's what he makes a living off. And when I run things by him, he has a completely different perspective on things. And then he says, how about, what if you did this? And then I'm like, okay, you don't understand what I'm saying. But 2 seconds later, I'm like, that's actually kind of funny. If I could turn this into something. And then it was just a spark, and then that just sent you flying somewhere. So I think sometimes get someone else's perspective on someone who doesn't know anything about it. That's always great input.
Very good. And then what about, I know you mentioned it previously, just a couple of actual sort of companies that do this very well. What about, are there any either sectors that really get the futures thing, as in, is the car sector this better than the food sector, for instance, or are there particular locations, as in countries, that have really got a grip on this?
So first and foremost, the country thing, I think, maybe sadly so, but of course the Western Hemisphere is pretty far ahead with the futures thinking. But the strange thing is that we're seeing way, way more optimism in working with futures in developing countries. And they are booming ahead right now. We are currently right now getting a lot of partners and alliances in Africa, especially by undergrads and, people fresh out of university who's been given a grant from a philanthropic foundation or anything to do something, and we can see that's moving along. So I would actually say the willingness, maybe the skill set is more developed in industrialized countries, but I think we're seeing a movement in what is referred to as the global south, if that term is still being used, where there's a lot of optimism, a lot of energy put behind it. As in terms of specific industries, you see these droplets out. I think you mentioned the automotive industry as one thing. I actually think that's a very interesting case study in the sense that I love seeing all these new players come into it with a completely new take. So let's say someone like, I don't know if you're familiar with the EV company, Rivian. It's essentially, they have sort of a... adventure as a theme, and then they're tech people. And they come in and they build a whole new sort of approach to how a vehicle could be. And it's really taken off right now, and it's going great for them. And I think that is a great case study of where you're combining something where you have the whole electric vehicle movement became an opportunity for tech people to go into transportation. And that's so funny. I think every time you have an opportunity to fuse something, whether that being two different industries that merges due to development, you can have a completely new prospect on it. But I think it's still on an individual organizational basis. I wouldn't as such say there's, besides the obvious, which would be tech. We do see a lot of tech people trying to really work long term, think ahead, but it's usually in the startup sector element of it. And the other thing is that more or less, so I would say they're pretty future oriented, but it might not be structured in the sense that I've learned foresight. They're simply just saying that we are actually creating scenarios for ourselves 20, 30 years ahead. Mm. There's also there's a narrative going on about the futures currently being talked, you know, in the UN or within the European Union and whatnot. And they're saying, well, that is fine. There are certain countries here who are in a position of luxury where they can talk about the future. Yeah. And the rest of the world doesn't necessarily have that. They have very immediate concerns right now and do not have the capacity or resources to even think far ahead. And they're like, well, maybe there isn't even a tomorrow. So of course there's that's a key perspective of it.
Mm-hmm. And then what about just back to the issue of sort of inspiration? Are you, and I'm sure you are, but in terms of being a great reader, any particular titles or authors that you would point to as being particularly influential on your perspective?
So I think one thing that really struck with me, I really got taken by, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the book, The Hidden Life of Trees, by Peter Wohlleben, and there's also Finding the Mother Tree by Susan Simard. I'm sure somebody might have seen the TED Talk by her. This whole thing, essentially about how we found out how trees or nature, also through mycelium, how everything is communicating and connected, not just through sound and smell and whatnot, but actually also by electrical impulses, sort of like in a brain. So we're looking at forests actually having as many synapses as a human brain might have. So is there a consciousness? I think that for me gives me this feeling of there's an answer, there's a secret or a truth in there that we need to learn to understand, and it's unraveling. It's very, very new. This research and these results came out in, I think, 2015. I think there's something in there which puts things into a way more holistic perspective. And I think maybe some of that is, if we learn what's in there, I think maybe we can move on from this immature adolescence that humankind is in. But of course, that's a very philosophical level. But that would for me be a suggestion, because it's going to affect the way you think work-wise and how you look at the greater scheme of things. And then I'm currently just reading, which I think a lot of people probably, especially listening to this podcast, The Creative Act by Rick Rubin. I just think he has a very interesting and sort of intrinsic view on creativity. He's very much, you know, let yourself be guided by your intuition and feelings, which is very, very interesting, I think.
Yeah, and certainly guided by intuition, or indeed sort of a passion in the moment, perhaps back to talking about philosophy, back to Rousseau, a great believer in that. So go on then, in terms of we're actually back to short to medium term futures. So what are you up to then, Jonas? What's happening to you or coming in your diary over the next perhaps several months or a couple of years?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, I think it's interesting to be in, you know, this, as we're talking about this paradigm shift right now. I don't think for a long, long time, we haven't been in a situation where there's so much opportunity to explore and experiment, think new ways. I also think in many, many ways, even business or whatnot, we've sort of found out that the model that we're going by right now is going to be finite, where it's not sustainable in the long run. And that's finally come through on pretty much every agenda. So I think it's interesting to move around in that sphere, cross-sector wise and trying to figure out, I think something's going to come up there. There's also the thing about something I'm quite involved with right now in some network groups, and I'm going to have some keynote talks. I can see that. So we, on one side, we're talking about that the philanthropic sector is seemingly taking a much more active approach in generating change. Back in the day, it was quite conservative and it just allocated, you know, it granted you a donation for an initiative, but now they seem to be more willing to step out there and take an agenda. And we can also see how that sector is growing. More and more large corporations and whatnot are, you know, establishing foundations or whatnot, contributing to a lot of societal issue. And I think that on one hand is very, very interesting, like looking at how much influence is philanthropy going to have in the future here, at least domestically, just here in Denmark. We're looking at a philanthropic sector which has now reached a level of investment magnitude that it's actually almost a competitor to the government. So if the government puts down a budget for creating schools, yep, we can see the philanthropic sector almost match it in loads and loads of billions being thrown at this. So that's very interesting. It's sort of this fourth dimension of creating change. And then one concern I have, and that's very much on the corporate side, is that I can see we started this whole journey years back about corporate social responsibility, and that was great. And how can they engage now that it has become, well, at least in many places, it's become law, especially here in Europe, that you have to. And the way you've made it into law is that you tell a brand, let's say Adidas or whoever, we want to see not just your annual report, but we also, in terms of finances, but we also want to see what are you actually doing in terms of your social responsibility. Yeah. But it's that, which is, of course, a good thing, but there's now so much focus on it being, it's becoming a reactive bookkeeping exercise, essentially. It's focusing on, okay, how can we document how much water, paper, you know, emissions that we have, and how can we bring that down? So a lot of times, some of these networks that I've partaken in, it's high-level finance people who are sitting in there. And that, for me, was a weird thing because that's all very internally based, whereas there's a massive potential in looking at, and maybe we should call it something else than there's corporate social responsibility. Fine, that's your responsibility towards the law. Second point is your corporate social, should we say, impact. So CSI is sort of like, what are you doing externally? Which agendas, societal agendas, are you engaging in? What are you supporting? What are you contributing to? What are you, you know, motivating your employees to get passionate about? I think there's so much to win, not just on like a marketing perspective in terms of positioning yourself, but also just in terms of, you know, a sense of purpose internally for your employees. And then there's also just a great business opportunities in creating this change. So I think I'm afraid that the CSR thing is just going to become internally. I think it needs to also have that external agenda. So that's one thing. And then the very last thing, which I'm very intrigued by and have been for years, and it actually started in my days at Chai Day, was this, how can we, because we are often talking about how can we democratize the future? Like how can it you know, not just be policymakers, whatnot. And the same thing I have about like product innovation or impact initiatives or anything. How can we tap into this? You know, how can we say the collective creative capability of society? How can we tap into this by ideating? I've met so many people who've had, you know, I remember at one point actually meeting a finance person at a big insurance company who had a wonderful idea for a recreation area in a European capital. And I said, that's an amazing idea. And the person, she just laughed and she said, yeah, but I'm not going to go out and be an entrepreneur, and I'm not going to call the mayor, and I'm not going to talk to my colleague here, the CEO, because we're an insurance company. We would have nothing to do with this. So you just constantly see all of these great, great ideas just dying out there. And I remember working on a Skunk Works project where we explored how could we tap into this. But the massive issue back then was input management. So how do we, you know, how do you give this input? That's one thing. But how do you then also manage all of this input? But I think that has completely changed right now, because now we've got GPTs. We got AIs that we can prompt with certain specific criteria and then shortlist great ideas. I think there is something in there, but that's sort of the frontier stuff I'm trying to explore.
That's absolutely fascinating. Well, Jonas, I could listen to you forever, as no doubt could the listeners, but unfortunately we're getting to the end of this conversation. And so just to everyone is entirely clear, by the way, where they can track you down and where they can follow you digitally, etc. Go on then. How can they do so and where?
Actually, I really need to get up on my game there, but I think the main channel for me is still sadly LinkedIn. I'm a listener on X, and my Instagram is very much personal. So I think still LinkedIn is the best place to connect, and also, usually share if I've done any interviews or articles in there or thoughts. But I promise I'll become better at getting onto other things.
Fantastic. That's a features thing for yourself. Well, in that case, All it leads me to do is to say to the deeply interesting and inspiring Jonas G. Mikkelsen, director at the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
Thanks for listening to The New Abnormal. This series is brought to you in partnership with the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, which helps clients become futures ready. Just so you know, the issues discussed in these podcasts also link to my speeches. Check out seanpeterc.com for more info. Please listen to previous conversations in this series with many other fascinating guests. But till next time, goodbye.